Welcome to the Sum of It All Bad at Math podcast. I'm Audrey Mendeville, along with my colleague Mark Alcorn from the San Diego County Office of Education. And this season, we're exploring the book Bad at Math, Dismantling Harmful Beliefs That Hinder Equitable Mathematics Education by Lydia Gonzalez. Transcripts to our podcasts are always available for you in the episode notes on your favorite platform. So this week, we're chatting about Chapter 7, Mathematics as Gatekeeper.
Yeah, for sure, Audrey. And as I was reading this chapter, I have to be honest, my mind would alternate between things that as an educator, I feel like I have control over and things I feel like I don't have control over. But I think, so a couple more thoughts about that. I think it's important, just as an informed citizen, to be aware of the things that are out of my control, maybe such as standardized testing, and some of the other things that are mentioned, because I may be in a position at some point to use the knowledge that is in this chapter to influence a vote that I might have the opportunity to give. Or I may be in some sort of a discussion with a district or even at the state level. But I also want to push this a little further, Audrey, and think about how, as a classroom teacher, a math coach, I might be able to disrupt this paradigm as mathematics as a gatekeeper, because I think that's really what our intention here is to disrupt that notion. So I was wondering, as we go through this episode, it might be interesting to talk about some of the ideas that sparked for us in ways that we as math leaders and classroom teachers, we could disrupt this idea of mathematics as a gatekeeper.
Mark, I so appreciate that. I think there's so much to this chapter that feels out of our control and really big and broad. And so I appreciate you kind of holding that as a yes, and that might be necessary at some point for us to be in that advocacy space. And how does it live in our local space? I love it. So kick us off. What's your first thing that sparked for you?
Well, the first thing I'll jump into is on page 116 is the phrase, mathematics is about performance. I think that historically has been very true and detrimental in many ways to students as they try to get into mathematics in their classroom. And one of the things that came to mind with that is why it's about performance is it, I did start thinking about grading and how when we have grades be the thing that are the most important thing for the test on Friday, I think mathematics is the area where test on Friday became a thing. That whole idea of grading being the thing that's so important really reminds me of something that's happened with my daughter and actually my son as well in high school. They had a math class where their teacher decided to shift how he had taught in terms of how, not necessarily just how he taught, but how he gave grades to students. And what he did is he started to include retakes and other types of ways of not averaging all of the scores together and really taking more of a stance of when you're learning it, if you're learning it and not just a high stakes moment that you have to learn it at this test at this time. And he put some parameters around it, so it wasn't a free for all that kids could retake tests all year or something like that. And I just noticed when my kids came home and they would talk about math class and they would talk about that they were going to get ready for a retake, I just noticed a whole change in the culture of how they were talking about math class. And the only way I could describe it is it just seemed more humane. It seemed less like they were a widget and it seemed like it was more about them learning. So I think that as we think about mathematics as a performance, I think that grading is something we might want to consider.
Yeah, I really appreciate that push, Mark, and that space of how we dismantle the notion that math is the gatekeeper might have to do with also really pushing on that idea that math is all about performance. And so powerful to think about how little things like the way we grade, and it's not even like you were talking about a complete overhaul, but some small moves this teacher made that really impacted the way your children felt and we're able to succeed in a math class. You know, another aspect of that is even just access to the math classes. And Lydia Gonzalez mentions in this text, the algebra project, on this idea that the right to algebra is a matter of social justice. And it's super interesting to think about who gets to take the math classes in the first place. Like, you can't even start talking about grades if, when you look across your class, not all the students are there. So super interesting to think about the spaces there we might have to kind of rethink some of our practices.
Yeah, good points, Audrey. You know, we've mentioned Robert Moses's work briefly in past seasons, but I'm wondering if it's worth taking a couple minutes right now to sort of just dive into that work a little bit with the Algebra Project.
Yeah, I would love to. You know, this book really changed a lot of how I view math when I read it. One quote I can bring into the space is early on in the book Radical Equations, which talks about the Algebra Project and is by Moses and Cobb. They say, the skewing of math along racial and class lines had the effect of sending the message to students of color that little was expected of them. And that's just that reminder that when you look across your classrooms and your classrooms don't represent your school community, what messages are being sent to students, even if it was, you know, the computer system did it that way. I promise we weren't trying to segregate or move kids into certain classes, but what's implicitly communicated when the classrooms don't reflect the school and the community?
Yeah, and just bringing me back to street data with that idea that perhaps it's not that the content is too challenging, but it's not challenging enough. You know, our students can feel that. They can feel like when we're not giving them something respectful to tackle, they can feel when they're, that we're coddling them versus challenging them with tough love, right? We played around with some language around this a few seasons ago, Audrey, if you remember. You know that phrase, high expectations, it just seems to be a phrase that has kind of lost its edginess, right? And then we talked about, you know, that phrase, presuming competence, that we have from humanizing disability with Paulo Tan, right? And then we even thought, like, maybe we can push the envelope a little bit more with the language. What if it's expect brilliance from each and every one of our students? So it's interesting to think about how, like, these slight shifts in language, they can encourage us to change how we're positioning our students. And I actually think even more importantly than that, how they respond to that shift, how they respond to the fact that if I'm looking at each and one of my students and I expect brilliance from them and they can feel that I expect brilliance from them, what a shift on how they can think about themselves and the mathematics.
Yeah, I really appreciate that, Mark. I really do. Speaking of expecting brilliance, one of the studies that happens and they talk about in Radical Equations with the Algebra Project is a parent who of a community who said, like, I'm super curious about the how we expect brilliance of our own students, our own children. So she sent out a letter to all the incoming seventh grade parents as a parent herself and had two questions. The first question was, do you think your child should take algebra? And do you think every child should take algebra? And the quote from the book says, the responses taught me a lot about the attitude towards math because all parents thought their child should do algebra, but not all parents thought that every child should do algebra. And that once they brought this to light, parents could see the contradiction between the way they expect brilliance of their own child versus brilliance of other children and children in general. And it ultimately changed what they decided to offer. So I just think it's super interesting, Mark, as you're talking about this idea of like shifting to expect brilliance, that we think about how we expand our own minds and remove biases around who we expect brilliance from.
That's great, Audrey. I appreciate us spending a couple minutes digging back into Radical Equations. I think it's a book that I would like to revisit after you've done a little connecting to it. Thanks for that. I also wonder if this is a time that we might clear up some misconceptions around the high school coursework in California. You know, I know I've talked to you and our other colleague about how, you know, the eighth grade course in California now actually it contains a quite a bit of algebra in it. It seems like there's this disconnect on sort of like, are we teaching algebra in eighth grade? Or are we not teaching algebra in eighth grade? And I wonder if you might be able to clear that up a little bit.
Yeah. So I think, and it's hard to speak to definitively because of course every school system can choose slightly different ways of doing this. But when I started teaching, what I taught in an Algebra 1 class is a high school course. And what I taught in a high school geometry course, about half of each of those courses now got combined in California and got made into the eighth grade math course. So the eighth grade math course contains about half of what I used to teach in Algebra 1 in the old days.
Okay.
In the old days, we'll put quotes around that. And then also about half of what I would teach in the second year of a high school course, which was geometry in that day, also gets taught in eighth grade. So this eighth grade course, a lot of people, because there were all kinds of names of courses before the 2014 adoption of our state standards that were eighth grade, really was problematic because people were looking up and saying, no, this is the equity issue we're talking about, is that students need to be taking algebra in eighth grade. And I think the answer to that by the standards writers would be like, yes, and they need to be taking some geometry. So we put half and half, you know, kind of like a nice mix, and that's what they're getting. And then when they get to high school, they're going to study those, you know, areas of math more in depth than they did previously.
Yeah, Audrey, that's really helpful because, I mean, when I hear you talking about it, it's pretty clear that there's some good content for kids to tackle in eighth grade, and it hasn't been watered down in a way that's not respectful to what we want to make sure that we have equity for our students. But that also makes me think of something else about high school mathematics. This whole race to calculus, right?
Yeah.
You know, because as you know, I have a couple kids at home that are going to college soon, and this was definitely a topic in our household. Is like, is taking calculus in high school really a ticket to certain colleges, or is that a myth that is part of this perpetuating cycle of mathematics that we kind of just stay on and we never get off of them? So what's your view on that?
Yeah, so much time we got, Mark.
Yeah, right.
I think what's super interesting here is that there's no way to really unpack fully the college admission process. And I think when children
That's true.
don't get into a school or do get into a school, we are likely to use all of our cognitive bias and assign it attribution to certain things. And one of those things I think we assign attribution to is they're either taking or not taking a high level math course. But the weird thing about this, Mark, is that nobody wants to experiment on this because it's experimenting with perhaps their own child, or children's futures, right? Like that feels like a high stakes place to like, let's try this out and let's not take math and see what happens, right?
Yeah, right.
Like
whoops, that didn't work.
That's not advice anyone wants to hear from their high school counselor, right? And say
no,
like,
no,
sorry,
no.
We really thought it was going to work, but I guess not, you know? So I think we need to, that's another space where, as you're talking about, what are the things we have control over and what are the things we don't have control over? College's admissions is a fuzzy space. And so that's a hard one to navigate.
Yeah. Well said, Audrey. I think that's true. Well, another light topic in this chapter, moving on to more light topics, Audrey, is standardized tests. Hey, you know, this should be a short segment. Not much there to say, right?
Definitely not. No, I have nothing to say. We're done. No, I'm just kidding. So I think whenever we unpack standardized tests, I don't know how often we like have this, you and I have this conversation often, but I don't know how often we've had this on the podcast. I don't think much.
Yeah.
Like, there was a reason for coming up with standardized assessments to begin with. They were intended as a tool for equity, right? Like, that's what it was intended for. It was intended to say, hey, in third grade, teacher, you can't spend the whole year on multiplication just because you love it, just because you think that's all your kids can handle, just because you have lots of fun projects for it. Like, there's a breadth of things you need to study, and here's how you're going to be held accountable to it. And that was there so that children in different zip codes across the freeway from each other, across the train tracks, however you want to imagine the divide in your town, would have experiences that were more alike than they were different, right? Mm-hmm. So that's where it came from. And yet that's not necessarily how it's actualized.
Yeah. And I mean, as an elementary teacher, I really lived through that, through the pacing guides and the pacing of content. And, you know, as a teacher, I always was really resistant around that. But then I had somebody one time tell me about the equity of it. And she said to me, well, Mark, if you don't teach those last three chapters that have implications for future grades, where's the equity in that for the students that needed that material because you decided to spend an extra month on something else? And so I have to say that gave me pause and made me think about the fact that, you know, yeah, standardized tests are broken the way that we have them now, but like the idea of equity of children getting the same content, as you said, as another school across town, I think that's something we need to grapple with.
Yeah. Or the teacher next door, even, right? It's something
yeah.
you
Oh,
to
sure.
think about.
Yeah.
But the reason I think standardized tests are so problematic is we don't have standardized children.
Yeah.
We know there's variability among children, and standardized tests don't allow for students to express their learning in any other way than whatever the chosen method is, whether it's the bubbles, whether it's the computer space where you drag
right.
and drop, whatever the thing is, like there's no alternative to, could I tell you how I think about this? Or can I draw you a picture in the space of how I think about this? Like there's no room for that. And I think in doing that, you have to think about who are the test makers and who is the audience of the test makers.
Yeah.
And that has been historically what we view in our society is this normative experience, which we know is not normative, but we have normalized a white middle class perspective and viewpoints. And that's what gets pushed as what we all have to have in order to pass the test, right? We have to be able to code switch into that space. And that's where we fall apart on these on this as an equity practice.
Yeah, you make a great point. And it, just bringing back to the myth of average, Todd Rose's TED Talk, right? And really how in education for years, we viewed our students that don't fit into that myth of average as in need of fixing. So these standardized tests become this method to identify students as not being able to make it, or and we've retreaded the view that these students are broken somehow and they're low in math and all the things that we assign to them when we use these tests. Really almost in a formative way, Audrey, it becomes, it's not summative data anymore. It's sort of like, I'm going to use this test score to, you know, determine your math future and so forth.
Yeah. Yeah. So that begs the question, if not standardized tests, if that's broken, what are we going to do that's more authentic? And the author starts to describe that idea of authentic assessments. What were you thinking? What ideas sparked for you in that way when you read that part of the chapter?
Well, a moment ago, I just mentioned the word formative assessment or the phrase formative assessment. And that's definitely something that came to mind as we start to think of something that is more authentic. You know, a few years ago, one of our colleagues mentioned something to me that was pretty profound. And, you know, sometimes we hear people talking about formative assessments, like they're these sort of individual events that you just like, you give a test. It's a summative test or a formative test. And she said something pretty profound. And she said that, you know, a formative assessment has to, I even call it now a formative assessment process. It has to include something you're going to do with that data that you're gathering in that formative manner. And I thought that was really a good thing for me to hear about, because then I realized that, you know, that is a way to collect data and act upon it versus something summative that's kind of finished at the end of a process. But something I have thought about over the last couple of years, Audrey, and I'm curious about your thought about, is this idea of exit slips. I mean, exit slips came about many years ago and people started using those at the end of a class period. And I wonder, after reading Street Data and thinking about really carefully about how we collect information from students about their thoughts around the learning, I wonder how, and after reading Street Data, I wonder how, like, these exit slips, are they really formative measures? Or have they sometimes become kind of a summative measure? So then all that to think about, like, what's the secret sauce that keeps an assessment process at the formative level versus it slipping back into this quiz that really just doesn't get acted upon? It's just sort of goes right to the grade back. It's back to the grading, right? So it's like, what is something that's just going to the grade book, and what's something that we're really going to act upon?
That's a great question, Mark. And it's super interesting that formative assessment as an area of interest is probably always gets like voted on last in
oh,
our
yeah,
area,
that's true.
right? Like,
yeah.
Folks are like, I got that, I do that, I'm good,
yeah.
I don't need to know anything about it. And yet we're not doing it, right? It's like this huge untapped potential lever for change if we can find that secret sauce, as you described it, and stop ourselves from taking the evidence and the information we gathered and just entering it in a grade book or just saying, okay, they know they don't know, but really saying, now what do I do with this, right? Like, what do I do with this information that changes my practice, that helps students where they're at right now based on this evidence? And I don't know if this goes back to that time gap. I don't know if it goes back to like, well, I collected the slips and the kids are gone, and by tomorrow I already have plans in the book for what I'm supposed to do tomorrow, right? Like, where do we give ourselves space to react with what's going on? And I think we have to slow ourselves down in that drive to complete things and say, like, how do I give myself space to deal with the evidence that's there and think about what I should do next? I
Yeah,
think
that's
it's
a
a huge
great.
space for us to grow.
Great points, Audrey. And it may even mean that I just stop giving an exit slip every day because it becomes this sort of habitual thing that has become this grade book entry. And so maybe we need to just press pause and just sort of consider what we're doing, why we're doing it. So good thoughts. Another thing that the author discusses is she talks about these capstone projects or math projects, kind of like something that, again, that students can do at the end of a period of learning. And I was thinking back, Audrey, to some of the project type things that I saw in elementary school classrooms, and I engaged in myself as a teacher. And I have to say they're just pretty much all over the map around different levels of quality and perhaps different like uses of time, good use of time or not. And I think in all cases that I can think of, at least that I was involved with or witnessed, they were well intended, but they sometimes became the burdensome compliance headache for students. It's almost like the students would almost maybe rather do something else. So it's back to this sort of thing, like how do you make this something that is really resonating with kids, so it's something that is much better than the alternative. So what's the best case scenario for this type of project? Does it look different in elementary versus secondary? How structured should it be? Should the teacher structure it? Should the student structure it? I just the last thing I'll mention, Audrey, is I know the author, talked about the idea of kids bumping into different math topics when they construct a project like this. But I thought about, like, I'm thinking about a third grader, and engaging in a project like this. If it was self-generated from the student, how is that something that is going to be something that is worthy of the time and really allows them to learn something that is important for them to learn in third grade? So lots of thoughts about how I might try to do that differently now with what I know over the last couple of years, but still lots of things to unpack, I think, Audrey.
I appreciate that, Mark. I think some of the things that you and I have talked about too include, like, how do we prevent ourselves from then having 12 posters around the room and kids spending 10 minutes talking about their poster and everyone else just hears the womp, 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 right? Like,
Big time, yeah.
so like part of it is, are these projects or these capstones designed with an authentic audience in mind? Because when they're not, our kids know that it's a glorified art project, and not that we shouldn't have more art in class. So not bagging on that, but like, it's not the math that we're worried about at that point in time, right? And I think we should just own why we're doing it. We want them to be able to develop a visually pleasing product, right? Cool. Like, that's what it is. It's not an in-depth math study. And there's other spaces where, like, I think if there's autonomy for students to choose what they're studying, they might bump into math, but they're more likely to bump into using the math practices and engage in math that they already know, right? And so I think teacher-created projects can thoughtfully bump kids into some math where they're like, "Ooh, I don't know how to do that. What am I going to do there?" And I've seen that in examples from
True.
different teachers, and
True.
then that's where their teacher can interject and say, "Well, here's the math. Here's your aspirin for the headache you have, right?" And you can go back to working on your project. But I don't think all projects are the same. I think you very articulately said that there are some that work better than others. But I also think we have to be honest about what purpose they're serving, and there's space there for maybe more than just the export, kids magically bumping into mathematics.
Yeah, good points. And I especially like what you said about an authentic audience. I think kids see when something is just the poster they're going to make to present. But if they're trying to solve a problem that might be on their campus or in their community, that they choose and they self-select into, I think there's a different level of motivation that. So I appreciate that example.
Yeah, for sure. So one other aspect that comes up with this that we were talking about is the college placement courses and remedial math. And I appreciate the author spending some time discussing this as well. Just this week, an article came out in EdSource on math as a gatekeeper, and it's looking at how the city universities in New York rethought math placement in and remedial classes. And so I'll link that article in the show notes, but super interesting. They thought about like essentially getting rid of remedial math. They said it was costing them like $1 billion, some
Wow.
insane amount of money. Maybe it's not a
Wow.
billion. I got to go back and read. Maybe I have my zeros off.
A
It was a lot of money, and they were like, this is insane. So they said, what happens if instead we stick kids straight into algebra and give them college algebra and give them a support class or give them something else?
lot.
And they noticed all kinds of really interesting things. And it's experimental data, it's not theoretical. It's like they tried it and they said, what happens? And they found that over the course of 7 years, the students who started in the remedial algebra eventually caught up and hit many of the same milestones as students who did not start in remedial algebra. And so there also is that question mark of like, well, maybe it works, or maybe it just helps kids get places faster. And so it's super interesting that one of their folks at the end said, at the end of our data collection back in the fall of 2020, the elementary algebra group and the stats group, they're not all that different, because as they enter the workforce and they gain experience, it's quite possible that their wages will catch up. And you just thought that was a super interesting point, like that people think it's still about getting somewhere faster. And on the balance side of that, Mark, is the reality is for each year you didn't earn the same amount of money as someone else, those are lost wages. Like there's a whole economic study of the fact that like you are losing out on thousands and thousands of dollars, tens of thousands of dollars over the course of your life because you took the other path. And so like, how do we navigate that, right? And who takes which path, and how are we figuring that out? So it's a big area for us to think about, I think.
Yeah, and I hear what you're saying about the wages. I think there's more to unpack with that. But I also think there's some things to think about besides wages and things that we lose with students having potentially negative experiences in remedial tracks is really just, I mean, these are people that grow up to avoid mathematics in their life. They avoid it in considering things in their civic duty. I mean, they're not interested in sort of like using quantitative reasoning perhaps to think about something that they need to consider that's part of our world. And I think something that's also really important, and this is something that I think part of our mission interrupt is how do they guide their own children that in their children's walk through mathematics? How do they position their own children? How do they think that their children will be successful or not? Many years ago, when I was in a master's program, one of our professors directed us toward John Allen Paulos's book called Innumeracy. And oh my gosh, that was quite an interesting read around sort of our society and not just this idea of illiteracy, but innumeracy. And so I think we need to consider those things too that we might lose when our students do not have successful experiences with mathematics.
Absolutely. I think it's a great point to bring up, Mark. And like in the thinking of how do we change math as a gatekeeper, and how do we change our beliefs and that are pervasive in our society around being bad at math, I think this is definitely a space for us to think about. But it's not just on the college and university side, it's also on that, end of high school side. We have a lot of conversations around like how do we rethink what else gets offered there and how else students can be successful in mathematics.
Yeah, and that reminds me of a conversation we were together, and you were talking to one of our TOSAs here in Southern California about the fourth year math courses that have been developed in California. And that comes to mind because this is an effort to try to rethink mathematics in high school, and versus this race to calculus. So I thought maybe, Audrey, it might be interesting for our listeners for you to share a little bit about what those fourth-year math courses are about here in California.
Yeah, well, I'll not be able to do them justice right now. So I will try my best to add some links and things in our show notes, but I also encourage you to check them out if you are in California. There's, they were all done as a series of projects with universities, local state universities, and our UC system and high schools, and saying, like, what else could we offer besides a calculus class? And it's thinking about what else goes there, what else is necessary. So there's introduction to data science that's been offered. There's a class called MRWC, and I'm going to totally mathematics reasoning. I'm totally blanking on the other letters right now. There's discrete math. There's a whole bunch of these. And the universities and the high schools together worked on designing the course. And they are now courses that anyone can adopt across the state of California to use as a bridge, right? As saying, like, if not calculus, what else, right? And how else do we continue to learn about math and explore math in other ways? Maybe think about other aspects of math that we haven't been thinking about in our race to calculus. And also maybe making space for us to think about what it looks like to be a mathematical thinker beyond high school and where that avenue leads. So lots of options there. But as I'm looking back at our time, Mark, and thinking about this episode, we've had just an interesting conversation based on what, like, this idea, if math is a gatekeeper, what's in our control to do differently? And I really appreciate just the aspects that the author provided that's kind of sparked your thinking around grading, formative assessment, projects, courses, and thinking about those spaces, but also, like, in remembering that on the other side of it, we do have a space for advocacy too. And so thinking about it in that theoretical space and thinking about it as, like, is it okay that math is a gatekeeper? Is it not? And thinking about the ways that we really can impact on a bigger scale are also important to us. So just a great challenge for each of our listeners this week. Maybe is it the thing that's practical in your system, and maybe the thing that also feels like a reach into advocacy to really change what's happening for our kids. A great time to think about it around this idea of math as a gatekeeper.
Yeah, I agree, Audrey. Thanks for a great summary. Well, thanks for joining us for this episode. In our next episode, we will chat about Chapter 8, Achievement Gaps or Opportunity Gaps. And we will continue to discuss how we dismantle harmful beliefs that hinder equitable mathematics in education. Until then, best wishes on rewriting the story of math.